It is when some statement of fact is given out that could by no normal means have entered the memory, that the psychologists fail to explain the process. We know that it is many times difficult to prove that the incident was never recorded at some time during the person's life. 195. But there are hundreds of cases where this has positively been proven. Now we think no investigator there has ever evolved a satisfactory theory as to how this fact was ascertained. You may know that the mind does apparently obtain facts during hypnosis semicolon, but even this has never been explained. If you can accept my statements, possibly you may be able to formulate a theory that will lead to the acceptance of the spiritualistic origin. When the facts are obtained in hypnosis, I have observed that there was always some spirit near who was interested in seeing that the experiment succeeded, and if it were possible, the facts were supplied in this way. I have never observed a successful hypnotic experiment which was not aided in this way. In psychometry, we must admit that the article itself does stimulate thought and ideas by vibrations which it sends out. But in elaborate descriptions, I have also observed spirit assistance. And usually being more impressionable than the medium, this spirit quickly grasps the more important features of the case and at once proceeds to obtain further information and supply it to the medium. It must always be remembered that every living being has one or more guides or spirits who are interested in that particular person. Sometimes in the case of the medium, an entire circle of spirits is at a moment's call, and it is always the delight of some of them to be able to supply the information desired, if it is at all obtainable. When it comes to predictions, we are still at a loss to give a complete explanation. We know that higher planes understand, but we have never solved the problem. If we ever get any light on it, it will probably be found that it is mostly beyond our control, even if we could understand it. The subconscious mind is always a mystery, seemingly, to investigators on Earth. To us it is only the memory part of our intellectual development or equipment. When Earth people are willing to concede that there is a soul or mind that uses the brain, perhaps they will understand a little better what the memory is. When they try to place everything in the material brain, they are at a loss to know how to account for the subconscious mind. But if they will only concede a spirit brain that controls the material brain, then it is easier to understand the relation of memory to the mental equipment. We think with mental machinery that is separate from the material brain. So we store the thoughts in ways that do not need the physical brain. But in mortal life, all conscious thought may influence, and usually does influence, the physical brain. So, in the same way, the store of memory records may, and oftentimes does, influence the physical brain. But as this storehouse is not in the physical brain itself, it is not so easily investigated. Hence the mystery concerning it. I think the subconscious mind has been burdened long enough. I would like to try to lift the load. We here know so well its limitations. But it is difficult to arrange any argument that will be convincing to critics there. When the subconscious mind is blamed for all the foolish things that purport to come from here, we feel that it is just as well to say nothing. But when our best efforts and finest teachings are laid to the same source, we feel that we must make some effort to have the critics understand. 196. The principal trouble is, of course, the failure to understand that the real mind and memory are not dependent upon the physical brain. And when the existence of a soul is denied, the case is almost hopeless. But when some are willing and even anxious to believe in a future existence for the soul, we cannot understand the obstinacy with which its real existence is denied. We know that the subconscious mind, through various methods of being stimulated, can send forth some interesting things. Interesting because unexpected. Yet we are not aware that any proof has ever been offered that unknown facts come from that source. In some cases it is suspected that the facts may have been somehow unconsciously acquired. Let those cases rest. But there are many where the facts absolutely could not have been normally acquired, and here there is no theory at all that will stand for a moment. We wish the critics who are willing to admit the existence of a soul as an animating force instead of a function, would take this as the foundation of a theory. They could then reach satisfying conclusions on many of these points, but they do not seem to want to do that. Study and education knowledge is always the goal here for those who have come to know what spirit life really means. But knowledge has to be sought. It is not to be picked up like wild fruit in the forest. It is here in abundance, but we do not always know where to find it. We each have our own desires. Some incline to one study, some to another. If a student makes some discovery, it is heralded abroad so that others can get the benefit. But before such discovery can be made, there is much preparation in the way of reading, attending lectures, and in conversation with other students. If a class wishes to follow an entirely new line of study or thought, they usually induce some advanced spirit to outline a course of study for them. In following this, it is surprising to see the different methods that the members of the class will adopt. Some are for reading all that has ever been written on each small phase of the subject. Some try to post themselves on just the main features. Others decide to only glance at it and run to something more to their liking. All are free to do as they please. There are no class rules laid down by some authority. As a consequence, the class, which may have been quite uniform at the beginning, will before long be in all stages of advancement on the subject. You can see from this that we are constantly changing, constantly meeting other students, constantly finding new angles to the study. We do not study all the time though. You must not think of our world as a university where each is striving to outdo the others and gain honors in some scholarship. Life is far different from that. I am only describing the study part. We all have our lighter moments, some more than others, to be sure, but no one studies every moment of the time. I am sure you will find the life delightful. I have yet to meet one who does not, after he has arrived at a certain stage of his education. We do see, however, that in the early stages, there are many who find life here somewhat disappointing. One who can only think of existence as a means to outdo someone else in money getting, is not attracted to study, is not happy in company with students, and in some ways finds life a burden. If he has really learned how to use his spirit powers, he can find pleasure in the musical performances and in some other ways of entertainment. But as time passes, he usually begins to learn and to experience the pleasure of doing things himself, and then his true happiness comes. If life on earth could be viewed as one of actively acquiring happiness, instead of passively allowing happiness to be brought to them, the earth would become a far more enjoyable place, and the entrance into this life would be a matter of joy, instead of one of penance, which it often is. 197 Communication between spirits. We have little use for vocal communication. Not that we do not often use it, but we more frequently receive the thought by direct impression. And in any communication of some extent, this is always the method, except when there is need for accurate statements that are not so easily presented by the action of thought. We often listen to lecturers in both ways, for a lecture is given vocally. But we can follow the thought at the same time. We do not always get a double impression in this way, for we can in a measure turn our attention to either method, just as you may listen to one person speaking when others are also talking near you. We think over these lectures when alone and fix them in our memory. In doing this, we do not send out any thought that anyone else could get. We also have here a sort of selective process. Our own thoughts are private unless we will that they go out. When several are together and thinking on one subject, there is a wave of harmony that is often felt or sensed that is sometimes an aid in fixing the thoughts in memory. So it is not unusual for a class to remain together while studying the information given by a teacher or spoken by a lecturer. You will thus see that the custom on earth of having pupils together probably has merit. You may not now be able to perceive any such influence, but the time will come when it will be recognized. We also find that different persons have different ability in sending out thoughts. There is as much difference in personality in this respect as you the find in the quality of the voice. We learn to recognize thoughts in the same way. You speak of hearing a familiar voice. We comment on recognizing a familiar thought or way of thinking. And our language has a word that expresses this, which you do not have. If we desire to impress several friends with a thought, we have to express it, or give it out, with a little more emphasis than if given to one person. Not so much to make it stronger, as to be sure that the varying receptive powers fully grasp all its intricate waves. For some persons detect one's thoughts easier than others. We are all accustomed to talk vocally when speaking to a stranger. We seldom succeed in clearly impressing a thought on a stranger until we each learn the other's peculiarities of thinking and receiving. In speaking to a stranger, we have a rather formal mode of speech. It is used because it is found best to adhere to one particular style so that all may be sure to understand. In our own circle, we lapse into familiar expressions, and some circles who have been together for a long time have acquired what might almost be termed a different dialect. But at large, one language is used for all, and our pet expressions are carefully avoided. You will be surprised when you come to see how we can chatter when we have a particularly congenial number together. We are far more free and familiar than you might expect. We have some wonderfully good times, but they are just a little difficult to explain to Earth people, for we grow into different customs and adopt different methods of thought and conversation. No one need fear, though, that enjoyment is lessened. We think it is greater in every way, for we have so little to detract from it, and so many things to enhance it. 198 Evolution. We have some different viewpoints here from those we held on Earth. It is not so serious an outlook to consider the waste of effort, the waste of life, that one meets there on all sides. Here we know better the meaning that lies behind it all, and realize that it is a small matter as compared with the wonderful scheme that lies behind all effort, all evolution. We know that no matter what ills life there may have to undergo, it is but a growing pain in the complete history of that life. When all is known, it will be seen that the evils of the earth life are for one purpose only, to train humans in the way to understand right from wrong, and to educate them to choose the right. In the process of evolution, many fall by the wayside, many strive and fail, many endeavors are frustrated. But the lesson remains, and the individual has grown to a slight extent. Life may be lost, time may be wasted, apparently, but the end has been achieved in some fashion. I am speaking of the effort as a whole. There are cases where evolution has failed in some individuals, and the result is downward instead, because of some perverse trait that turned the effort in the wrong direction. But this is far less than is generally believed. All failures, so-called, are not failures. Many prove to be the greatest successes, for an impress has been made on the soul that will last through eternity. Sorrow is there, to be sure, but sorrow is often a blessing in disguise. When man can learn that it is the effort that counts most, he will think less of the failures and more of the personal benefit that has been achieved. For everyone who fails to gain this education, there are thousands who find that their character has been strengthened, their lives made to have more meaning, their happiness, their final happiness, much enhanced. We know that the man who goes through life without effort, who has every want supplied, is apt to be the greatest loser. He has obtained no wealth that he can bring with him to this world. If all could realize that effort is the building material out of which character is constructed, there would be more personalities who would stand out as conspicuous examples of attainment. In the past generation, you placed all emphasis on the so-called successes. The failures were not considered. How could you have overlooked this important part? For, if anything, failure makes a greater impression on the character than any success. When man learns the full truth of this, there will be less disappointment over the ones who fall short of their ambitions. It might seem that such a view takes away all incentive to succeed, but while material success counts for so much in that life, there is little danger of that. And if the time comes when material achievement has less value, there will have come also the knowledge that success should be the goal for honor's sake, if nothing more. This thought should help the downhearted. It should spur the successful one still more. There is so much sadness there over things that to us seem unimportant. Happiness could be the lot of many who are now feeling the loss of some venture, some labor, some great effort. It is all education, and education maketh the full man. 199. The Chinese philosopher. We have a visitor from a foreign circle who has been with us some time. He formerly lived in China, and was a thinker when on earth. He has continued his thinking here, and as thought has a universal language, he is at home in all circles, although he knows enough English to converse in that tongue. He says, "We strive to send the truth through all channels that offer, but it is only in a few instances that we find that it gets through as we wish. I am hoping I can add a little to your records as opportunity offers. It has seemed to me that the Earth people need nothing more than they need an understanding of what is meant by the brotherhood of man, and it seems to me the time is opportune for something to be said from here that will aid in bringing enlightenment. So if I can have your time and pencil when you feel that you can write, I shall be pleased to try to give you my ideas on this subject. I will likely be with this circle for some time, so you need not feel hurried." Then someone in the circle added, "You will enjoy his talks, we know. He has been here many years, but has never lost his interest in earth affairs. He is Chinese, and was a man of note among his people, but probably not one whom you could identify." To this, at another time, they added, "We have learned much from this Chinese philosopher who will write for you. He is a wonderful spirit, and has been a great addition to our circle. He tells us of the old ideas of the Oriental races, and later we hope he will tell you his ideas of the religions of Asia as they have developed through the centuries. He was a great student and thinker when on Earth, and had access to many old books that are not generally known. When he came here, he at once plunged into the same studies with the aid of the libraries here. Later, he began the writing. I have been in the circle where your language is understood for a long time. We do not use it, but I have become somewhat familiar with it, and with your assistance I think I can express my thoughts in it. We will begin by saying that the ideas I have wanted to express are religious for the most part, but to a certain extent they have with me been linked up with history. I am therefore inclined to refer to historical events at times in order to give authority to my statements. When the Chinese nation was first organized, it was scarcely more than a loose union of various tribes. But in a few centuries it became much more unified. And when the early writers put forth their books on ethics, there was a large nation ready to receive and adopt the precepts taught them. So the teachings of Confucius and Lao Tzu soon became the common property of all who could understand them. When Buddha was born in India, China was not quite ready for a common religion or standard of ethical thought and conduct. And it was therefore much later that the Buddhistic doctrines were circulated in China. When the early teachings of Chinese philosophy were brought into contact with Buddhism, they suffered thereby, and for many centuries Buddhism held full sway. But as the priesthood connected with this religion became more powerful, the value of the religion as a guide for the people waned in direct proportion. 200. Then the old precepts of Confucius and Lao Tzu were resurrected and added to the remnants of Buddhism that still existed, and for the most part, that is the condition of religion and ethical thought in China today. But here and there among the more studious and thoughtful of the Chinese people there have appeared certain thinkers and writers who have had the courage to go deeper than most into the meanings of religious teaching, and through these there has been kept alive a philosophy that is well worth studying by any people of the world. We have always been a thoughtful people on the whole, and we have taken time to think. We are conscious that we have evolved in this direction far more than any other nation. This is not said in a spirit of boastfulness, but as a statement of fact. India has had thinkers also, but Buddhism there has given way to the earlier forms of religion again, and the diversity and multiplicity of gods has led to a thinking that is not as solid and unified as has been attained among the Chinese. When the Chinese have had cause to wage war with another people, they have always done so as a matter of self-defense. We have never been an aggressive people. We have encouraged peace, we have thought only of peace. And this spirit has impressed itself in many ways. It has made it much easier to avoid quarrels and disputes, and so has always had a tendency to induce a true brotherly spirit. When we have studied the early religions, we find that the principal features of them are the thought of a continuance of life after death, and of the effect that right living on earth would have on that life. Your Christian religion is the same at heart. So we can safely conclude that there must be some reason for such unanimity of plan. We have only one solution, and that is that there has always been influence from those who have gone before, and who have learned the things which are essential. It is in the application that the various races have made of these impressions, and the additions that have been made in their use, that the religions differ materially. In any case, the foundations are sufficient for right living if faithfully followed, and with understanding. In the course of the centuries, the Chinese race had evolved further ideas, or has possibly received further impressions, which we think are aids in the effort at right living. Many of these have found their way into general literature on the subject. Some are still unknown to the world at large. It is my pleasure to try to give you a few of these ideas, these precepts. It has always been the custom of our writers and thinkers to express themselves in what you might call aphorisms. It is in this manner that I have arranged what I wish to say. We have always felt that an idea should not be buried too deeply in wordy explanation. If possible, it should be put in a form where the idea seems to be expressed by the sentence, rather than by the words that form the sentence. You may remember that Confucius says, "No man should carry more than one dish at a time." I should like to change this to read, "No man should carry a dish until he understands its fragile nature." I mean by this, that we should not attempt to teach ideas which we cannot perfectly express. You may not get my exact words, and possibly that may be just as well, for my exact words might not be the best ones. You must remember that your language was unknown to me when on earth, and it is not easy to acquire here where all language is new and so different. 201 I would like to give you a few of our old sayings that tend to show or explain our idea of the great Creator. When I look back to my life there, I am conscious that we did not think as much of our origin as we did of our progress. We paid little attention to the power that caused our existence. But there were rare times when our thoughts did turn in this direction, and I find in my memory some of the records of these thoughts, some of them my own, some from greater minds than mine. When God rules, why should we try to usurp his power? In strength of character there is the reflection of the mind of God. It is always best to turn to the Almighty power when our own power fails. Many times when we grow faint-hearted, it is only that we loose the tie which binds us to him who supplies all power. Some lives are failures because the individual fails to understand that he is only a tool in the hands of the great skilled worker. When we doubt the value of life, we doubt the existence of the Creator. In searching for happiness, remember what causes happiness. We are apt to forget our blessings when the storms prevent our journey. If one can remember why he was happy yesterday, he may be happy tomorrow. It is always best to burn the weeds lest the seeds spring up anew. When we are ready to live, it is usually time to die. If men love beauty, they become beautiful. If hope hangs herself, love is strangled also. Many can learn if the few are taught. When love forsakes, life is gone. If love is worthy, it lives forever. When love survives, nothing else matters. If death is sure, life is certain. When old men laugh, young men should take heart. If your conscience bids you stop, heed it. If a man bids you cease, question him. When the earth dissolves in smoke, man will still be pursuing his onward path. 202 It is the soul that lives. The mind is only its guide. It is the egotism of a man that causes him to sneer at immortality. The geography of the heavenly spheres, you no doubt have often wondered just where heaven is located. So far as I know, there has been little attempt to indicate from here the position of the various planes. I am not thoroughly posted myself, but I have given it some attention, and I believe I can explain it in a manner. In the first place, the statement that heaven is all about you is correct to a certain extent, for spirits of the lower circles come and go freely through the earth's atmosphere. But it is not the real abiding place of any spirit who realizes where he is. It is in the farthest limits of the atmosphere that the heavenly lands begin. We always speak of it as a sphere, and this is a proper designation, in a way, in that it surrounds the earth at a fairly uniform distance. But in another sense this does not fully express the conditions. We will have some difficulty here in making you understand just how this spirit land is placed. It is not the inside of a hollow shell, nor is it the outside of a sphere. It is more nearly described as consisting of various regions, you might almost call them countries. Their extent is impossible to convey to you, because distance is such a relative term. We will have to make a general statement and say that these regions are thousands of miles in extent. They are not like islands in the sky, and yet how else can I describe them? I know I am indefinite, but I am doing the best I can. It is in these regions or countries that spirits of the lower plane have their homes. They are not replicas of any portion of the earth, for we have no cities. Sometimes the homes are not far apart, but there are no congested sections. There is room to spare for everyone, and always will be. If you were to attempt to explore these countries by any means at your command, you would sail about in many directions to find the various places. And if you desired to stop and investigate any one of them, you would find each one very extensive. But you must keep in mind that distance means nothing to us. It is possible to encircle the entire lower plains in a few seconds of Earth time, although it is customary to use a rather slower speed than that. We do not think of these various places as being separated, for we make no attempt to move any distance except through space. We have clairvoyant vision of nearly everything, but it is all under our control. We see comparatively little of our surroundings except as we experience a desire to view them. If we wish to go to any place, it is only a question of desire and willpower, and will most immediately at the place we had in mind. It is a vague picture I am drawing, no doubt. It is not a vague country, I assure you. It is more real to us than even the earth with its mountains and oceans. There are other spheres beyond these lower regions. Few of us have actual knowledge of them, except by descriptions given by the few visitors from them, and from messengers who are trained to go to and fro. It is said that they grow more and more ethereal, and soon are beyond the ken of any with whom we communicate. 203 In making journeys to other planets, we no doubt go by them, but we cannot see them any more than you can see our sphere. It is all a question of advancement, an acquirement of higher senses, a knowledge of the more ethereal conditions. We are told that some communicators mention the spheres by numbers. It is true that there are circles of advancement here on this lower plane, but it is difficult to understand why they are numbered when communicating. It may show a little the extent of the advancement, but I assure you we do not have them ticketed. It is easy to fall into the suggestions given by earthly inquirers, and many seem to have done so. The end. More on the Charlotte Elizabeth Dresser and Mr. Dot Rafferty, on http://ebritain.blogspot.no/2012/12/dfr and sys looking for charlotte.html. Some of it here. Charlotte Elizabeth Dresser lives with her mother, Clarissa Amelia, who is of independent means for those of the period, in the Starkbridge area, through the 1900 census, which lists she and her mother as the entire household. She is featured from time to time in the Starkbridge area newspapers, participating in musical events, engaged in charitable work, and lecturing on topics related to music, both church and secular. In 1904, Charlotte is living in Los Angeles, and soon thereafter moves south to Santa Ana, where she advertises her services as a music teacher in local papers. Shortly thereafter she meets and becomes intimate with Fred and Carrie Rafferty, and begins traveling with them in California. The Raffords and Charlotte do not appear in local papers after 1914 or so, suggesting Fred and Charlotte both retired. Charlotte clearly has independent means. She is buying and selling property on a regular basis, and she is traveling en ménage with the Raffords, in 1911, through the Mediterranean, in 1914 to England, and in 1916 to Hong Kong, Java and China. After Carrie Rafferty's death c. 1917, she and Fred Rafferty investigate spiritualism, and their work together is reproduced in part in the two spirit texts mentioned here. In 1927, Charlotte and Fred travel to Sweden. Fred is 65, and Charlotte is 81. Sometime shortly thereafter, Charlotte dies. In the 1930 census, Fred is living alone at his usual address, and he has new neighbors next door. Fred is not listed in the 1940 U.S. census.